This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
At this moment, Afrikaners are under threat. I mean, the ANC government is blaming actually the white people of South Africa for all the problems that is happening.
That's Peter Groenewald, the leader of South Africa's Freedom Front Plus party, discussing the reasons for white nationalists' gain in recent election. Details coming up. Also, Sudan's ruling military council announced there was an attempted military coup and at least 16 officers have been arrested. And a huge blast hit a popular hotel in the heart of southern Somalia port town of Kismayu. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Sudan's ruling military council, TMC, and protest movement leaders had agreed last week on a joint sovereign council that will rule for 3 years while elections are organized. Both sides say a diplomatic push by allies was key to ending a standoff that raised fears of a civil war. But now, Sudan's ruling military council announced there was an attempt to block the agreement by perpetrators of a military coup, and at least 16 officers have been arrested. I asked our reporter in Khartoum, Naba Mohadin, to brief us on this latest incident.
Sudan's ruling transitional military council yesterday, announced that they had failed a coup, which was planning to take over power and to cancel the agreement between the FCF and the military council. In the same time, while opposition and people were waiting for the agreement to be signed in the late night, and they held a press conference in national TV, briefing and explaining how the coup was made and how it was failed, and they accused 16 officers from Islamists and claimed to be arrested, that they arrested them yesterday.
What is the motive behind this?
Due to TMC claims about this coup and its number three coup announced this year, they said that they want to restore the former regime and they are Islamists, so they don't want the change that it should be made by the agreement between opposition leaders and transitional military council.
The military has said there was a coup attempt. Were government institutions or army barracks taken over? Was a radio station taken over? What actually happened?
When TMC announced the failed coup, there was no any military movement in the street. There was no any suspicious activities, or nothing was announced in the TV or the national broadcast. So they announced it yesterday, but there was no any scenes in Khartoum Street and no eyewitness for anything.
Naba, a few days ago when we were talking about the dawn of a new era in Sudan because of the agreement. And today, there was so much optimism a few days ago. Now we have this. What is the mood of the people in Khartoum and in all of Sudan right now because of the situation?
When people were celebrating, they had suspicious optimism because they think that TMC will do anything to just cancel the agreement. This is what people are feeling or were feeling at that moment. And now people are frustrated, and they think the failed coup and anything related to what TMC is announcing is just a trial to get rid of the agreement, because whenever they announce a failed coup, they said that Islamists want to restore the former regime. So people, they think that TMC is breathing a message saying that you should accept the agreement the way it is, or Islamists will have the regime back. So people right now are so frustrated, and they think that the agreement will never be signed, and they are ready for any escalatory steps.
And that was Naba Mohadin in Khartoum with the latest in Sudan politics. A court in the Sicilian capital Palermo ruled today that an Eritrean man extradited from Sudan to Italy because he was suspected of being a human trafficking kingpin known as the General was a victim of mistaken identity. Madhane Tasfamari Ambarhi was arrested in a coffee shop in Khartoum and extradited from Sudan 3 years ago. His defense lawyer, Michael Calantropo, said his client cried with joy when he heard the court decision. Applause broke out in court, and Barhe's relatives in the courtroom rejoiced, as did supporters of his innocence outside the court. The lawyer added that Palermo court, however, convicted his client of a lesser charge of aiding two cousins to immigrate to Italy illegally. The sentence was a fine of $112,000 and a 5-year prison term, though he could be freed for time served. Calantropo said the court's decision would be appealed. During the trial, Barhe told the court that Sudanese police had beaten him and stolen his identification document. He always insisted he was a refugee at a camp in Ethiopia. South Africa's Freedom Front Plus Party, whose aim is to establish a white homeland in this majority black country, surprised political observers by winning 10 parliamentary seats in the May elections. That result has vaulted the party to prominence for the first time and highlights how extremists are edging into the mainstream of South African politics. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Klerksdorp, South Africa.
White nationalism has long lurked on the fringes of South African life, stoked by far-right groups who feel their culture is under threat in this multiracial country. But as the May election showed, far-right white nationalism is moving into the mainstream and into the government. The tiny Freedom Front Plus party surprised many by grabbing 2.4% of the vote in the polls. That gave them an unprecedented 10 seats in the 400-member National Assembly. The party's aim is to create a homeland for the nation's mostly white Afrikaans-speaking minority, who are descendants of Dutch settlers 4 centuries ago. Party leader Peter Groenewald told VOA that the threat to Afrikaans speakers is a pressing priority for him.
At this moment, Afrikaners are under threat. I mean, the ANC government is blaming actually the white people of South Africa for all the problems that is happening. We are in the process of expropriation without compensation of our properties. They always blame the white people. The narrative in South African politics is that the white people have stolen the land.
But analysts argue South Africa's narrative and concepts of identity have changed radically since the end of apartheid in 1994. Political analyst Ralph Matega says Afrikaner rights groups are reading from an outdated text, which places whites at the top of the social structure.
It appears that they are not being able to let go of that historical supremacy. The reason I'm saying this is not because I'm totally against what they are doing, but they have not reformulated the sense of identity. If being an Afrikaner in the 1970s, it is the same as being an Afrikaner in 2019. We're in trouble then.
In recent years, figures in the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters, the Opposition Democratic Alliance, and the ruling African National Congress have also used race to stir supporters. The EFF has been especially strident, demanding that key economic sectors be nationalized and controlled by blacks, similar to what Robert Mugabe tried to do in Zimbabwe. Again, analyst Ralph Matega.
It's a clear indication of the emergence of extremism in South Africa's politics. It is actually Freedom Front Plus, their performance is a symptom of the body politics of South Africa. It is actually how South Africa's body politics work. It is how other parties are well positioned.
Freedom Front Plus's Groenewald, an original founder of the party and a longtime MP, says he has long tried to work with the ruling ANC to meet his party's aims. He says one of his short-term goals is to abolish race-based affirmative action in the country. Anita Powell, VOA News, Klerksdorp, South Africa.
Witnesses say a huge blast hit a popular hotel in the heart of the southern Somali port town of Kismayu, followed by an assault by armed militants. There was no immediate word on casualties. The Al-Shabaab group claimed responsibility through Al-Andulu Radio, the group's mobile Jihadist FM station. Regional government officials and a member of the country's federal parliament were reportedly in the Asasi Hotel. Clouds of smoke rose from the scene. Witnesses told VOA Somali service that an explosive laden car hit the hotel's front entrance. Then armed men stormed the building. A heavy gun battle ensued with security forces. Several smaller blasts, presumably hand grenades, were heard. The attack comes as preparations are underway for regional elections. The port town was once served as a major Al-Shabaab stronghold. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Sudan's ruling military council announced there was an attempted military coup and at least 16 officers have been arrested. White extremists are edging into the mainstream of South African politics. And a huge blast has hit a popular hotel in the heart of the southern Somali port town of Kismayu. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In Zimbabwe's capital, electricity service is only available overnight. That forces a lot of residents to go to work when they would prefer to be sleeping. Columbus Mavunga stayed up late one night to file this report from Harare.
Most parts of Harare get electricity for only 7 hours per day, and the hours usually come during the overnight when there is less usage and power stations can meet demand. Once the electricity comes on around 10 p.m., Harare lives up to its local title as the city that never sleeps. For the next 5 to 8 hours, businesses that need electricity to function spring to life even on cold, blustery winter nights. Nelson Mujue, who manufactures door and window frames, says he's recovering from a cold he caught while working overnight. He has an appeal to President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government.
If the government can give us electricity during the day, I think we can be able to meet our targets. Because actually we actually getting some orders from clients and we won't be able to meet our targets. Yeah, I've missed a lot of targets and I've got complaints from a lot of clients. They think I'm being slow with my work, but there are some factors affecting us. Of course, they know there are some factors, but they think sometimes the client will think he's lying, he's busy doing something for someone else.
Other business owners say they have tried to use generators so that they can work during the day. But fuel, like many other basic goods in Zimbabwe, is scarce and expensive. This week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa dispatched his energy minister, Fortune Chasi, to negotiate with Mozambique and South Africa to provide more electricity to Zimbabwe. Harare hopes the talks will bear fruit after it paid $10 million in debt to South Africa last month. Chasi says the government can only retire the remaining debt of $70 million to South Africa if citizens pay about $100 million they owe to the country's utility company, the Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, ZESA.
We all need to pay our debts to assure ourselves of power. I also want to make a specific public appeal to commerce and industry. They also owe significant amounts of money, and we would, without power, they can't operate. And when they don't operate, life becomes very difficult for all of us.
While experts say the economic impact of the ongoing power shortage is not clear, they say the moribund economy will suffer even more if the situation is not quickly addressed. Mujua will suffer as well from loss of income and possibly clients, and from the effects of working in the cold and long winter nights. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Rwanda's Court of Appeal has rejected the petition of a military colonel convicted of involvement in a plot against President Paul Kagame, who was seeking bail after 3 years in jail. He says he has suffered from illegal conditions. Tom Byagamba was the head of the Rwandan Presidential Guard. He was convicted of tarnishing the image of the state for public insurrection, illegal possession of firearms, and other charges. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali.
The case of Byagamba also involved retired Brigadier General Frank Rusagara and retired Sergeant Francois Kabayiza, all sentenced to lengthy jail terms by the military high court 3 years ago. They were back in court. Each cited ill health as one of the grounds for seeking bail. They also said they are detained at Kanombe Military Barracks instead of Malindi Military Detention Center, as the military high court had directed. They claim they live in terrible conditions and are inaccessible to their families, so they feel isolated. The Court of Appeal found their claims baseless, and lawyer Hul Pierre Celeste was frustrated.
It is a very, very big deception. I'm not happy with the decision. My client is not happy, but this is a court ruling. We must take it as it is.
The prosecution opposed their bail application, citing the seriousness of their offenses and the weight of sentences in the case of Byabagamba and Rusagara. The March 2016 verdict saw Byabagamba jailed for 21 years, Rusagara 20 years, and Kabayiza 5 years. The court also stripped Byabagamba of his military rank. Critics say Colonel Tom Byabagamba is paying the cost of attempting a coup in 2015. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Niger has one of the highest known child marriage rates in the world, with 3 out of 4 girls in the West African country married before age 18. But some girls are refusing this traditional cultural practice and are being helped by women who were themselves forced into child marriage. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has this report by Anne Nzuenkwe in Niamey, Niger.
24-year-old Barkisa Chaibu meets twice a month with Nigerian girls to discuss their right to oppose arranged marriage. The United Nations says 3 out of 4 girls in Niger are married before age 18. Chaibu is taking a stand against child marriage because she herself was forced to marry at the age of 12 and drop out of school.
My sensibilisation fixes les jeunes filles.
Barkisa says her awareness is to give information to young girls. They need to know what they want, know where they want to go, and what to do to get there. She argues, if the girls know their goals, their ambitions, they will know where to go and how to get there. They need to know that they always have a choice, the choice to say no. Chaibu became a medical student after having her marriage annulled. But it took 5 years of fighting against her parents and the support of police and an aid group. One such group, SOS Women and Child Victims of Violence, has helped thousands of Nigerian girls escape forced marriage.
Le plus souvent, nous saisissons le procureur de la République.
Miriam Moussa, coordinator of SOS Women and Child Victims of Violence, says the NGO often grabs the public prosecutor's attention. By doing this, he then forces the parents to renounce the marriage and makes them sign a commitment that they will not marry off their daughter. But the fight against child marriage in countries like Niger, one of the poorest in the world is not easy. With limited incomes, many parents focus on boys' education and marry off their daughters early. Niger's President Issoufa Mahamudu, at the July 7 African Union Summit in Niamey, vowed to boost prospects for girls. He says the employability of girls needs to be strengthened. The girls must have access to a job. They have to finish school with a career. That's what can make it easier for them to find a job. That's what can allow them to be more autonomous. For a part, Chaibu urges girls to spread the word to their friends that nobody can force them to marry and they have the right to remain children. For Anne Zwanke in Niamey, Niger, Moki, Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News.
Ride-hailing company Uber is considering expanding to Senegal's capital, Dakar, but in a city full of taxis and drivers without smartphones, the San Francisco-based company faces a number of obstacles, as VOA's Isha Sarai explains.
In most parts of Dakar, at any time of the day, it's easy to find transportation as taxi drivers compete for business. But Uber is considering taking its services to the city. According to Francesca Uriri, Uber's head of communications in West Africa, the company is aspiring to be everywhere.
And this means that any progressive, forward-thinking city which has a need for safe, reliable, and efficient transportation is essentially where we want to be. We are part of a broader mobility movement in establishing smart cities of the future, and we'll continue to explore these options in West Africa.
But Uber, which operates via smartphone app, will have to overcome many challenges to work in Dakar, including contending with a lack of fixed addresses. Sagone, a Dakar resident who recently traveled to New York and used Uber while there, says much will have to change before the company can operate successfully in Dakar.
It might work here, but it will require lots of investment because we don't have the same organization as in the U.S. Like, when you are coming to my house, I will not be able to tell you exactly where my house is located on the map. So you will have to, you know, I will have to tell you a building or somewhere, a school, somewhere I can pick you from.
With most taxi services in Dakar, riders and drivers must negotiate prices first. Some drivers say they would be happier with a fixed price based on mileage and time. Gora Sen has been a taxi driver since 1998. Sen says he is open to the idea of Uber establishing a presence in Dakar. He says that he thinks Uber could do well in Dakar if the company works with local drivers who know the city and have experience driving there. Uber currently operates in 23 cities in Africa. In West Africa, Uber has a presence only in Ghana and Nigeria. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Dakar.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Regis Audrius, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com,
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.